This is an exam. That voice recording is in progress.
You remember doing sort of modern languages at school and having to do
Yes.
oral examinations. Well, this is the same level.
You have like a little bit of banter with the teacher, then all of a sudden there's like click. Is that
Recording in progress.
is
And
that...
I must inform you that if you screw this up for me,
Yes.
I will see to it that you are fired. This is a special episode of the Careless Talk Climbing podcast. It is going to be an episode of the Careless Talk Climbing podcast. I did think about uploading it separately, but I'm not going to do that. Partly because it's a week sorted. That's a week where I don't have to try and scrabble together a guest and edit on Tuesday night. But the reason why it's a special episode this week is because Aiden isn't here. Did you hear that, bro? That was the sound of 90% of our listeners turning off. Yeah,
Apologies.
so we haven't got Aiden this week, and the reason for that is because I'm talking to my own dear brother. And we've had a lot of requests from the patrons, and some just generally non-patron members. And they want to hear a little bit more about the backstory to the climbing walls. And seeing as I chatted to Aiden about it, and it felt a little bit like if we did it with Aiden here, it would be like going to a school reunion that he didn't attend. So he wouldn't really have anything to contribute to the kind of stories of how we ended up here. But we got some questions from the patrons, and we're going to run through the story. We're going to focus. So Ben and I are involved with two walls. We're involved with the Boreham climbing wall in Coventry and social climbing in Leicester. We're going to be focusing 99% on the Boreham climbing wall in Coventry. And the reason for that is that was where it came first, but also Ben and I were involved in that from the very beginning, from when it was just an idea. And we actually came on board the social climbing project relatively late. So a lot of the early stuff that people are interested in, we didn't really have much involvement with at social. So this is going to be mostly, so if you're wondering at the end why we barely covered social climbing, that's why. But to start off with, yeah, we just want to chat about how it all started. When was the idea born?
I think the idea was born out of being significantly bored in our current jobs. And I remember a weekend when we went back to the farm to see our dad, and we were discussing, and I think it was you that probably threw out as a sort of dreamboat concept to own a climbing wall.
No, actually, it was slightly different. So even though that's the first thing I've asked you, I'm going to correct you already.
Please.
To set the tone for the whole interview, is you're going to sit there and watch me talk it all through. No, what happened was, yeah, you're right. We went back to the farm, and I was feeling a bit blue, as I often was, sort of when everyone's driving back. You know, that sort of like you've got everyone's just packing up after a nice family weekend and they're heading back home. I was feeling a bit blue about it, and I think you could, you know, we were talking about, you know, just not really being happy in our perspective
That's certainly
jobs.
true.
And you asked me, you said, if you could do anything, what would it be?
Okay. I do. So was this the famous Clio chat?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So we were sat outside. I drove a fantastic 2006 Renault Clio. Despite working
Don't even the year. It was a fine car. It was
was.
a car that our parents bought for us to learn to drive in. And I, despite being the younger brother, learned significantly earlier than Ben.
The system is broken.
But did put a sizable dent into that car when I wanted to see what would happen if I turned it off whilst driving.
In the way.
And if that doesn't show you that I wasn't ready to pass my test, then I don't know what will. I
Got very
remember,
lucky that it wasn't written off.
well, I remember passing that test by having to do a bay park at the end of that test and literally just being like, Jesus, take the wheel, closing my eyes and just turning the wheel. And it just went straight in. So, but anyway, yeah, I put a
Meant
sizable
to
dent. So, Ben
Yeah.
never really forgave me for that. But then Ben ended up inheriting that car, and it was I mean, you reversed it into a bollard, so...
I did, at speed. So I reversed that into a bollard at speed. I think everyone was quite surprised. I actually worked at Deloitte in financial services and sort of real estate tax. I think everyone assumed you earned huge money. But it turns out if you commute into London from Cambridge and rent your own apartment and are the lowest rung on the totem pole, you have no money, which did lead to gross dissatisfaction from myself. And I remember you were in the same boat. You know, you were a physio, and I think not hating life, but not enjoying the job so much. And I think we were both sitting around, you know, mulling, you know, what would we prefer to be doing? And I had absolutely no clue. So, you know, I've got all, you know, always got you to thank for coming up with the idea of opening a climbing wall. And then we just started running with it.
I forget. How much were you climbing back then?
A decent amount. Yeah,
you
yeah.
Were so climbing.
I was a regular at Kelsey Kerridge in Cambridge. Probably climbed three to four times a week. Regularly smashing out V8s. Not too proud to say that. Sadly, you know, some mean people might cast some aspersions on the quality of the setting at Kelsey Kerridge.
The grading was generous, wasn't it?
Generous at best. Generous at best. But
heartwarming grades.
It made me feel good coming home every day, sending those V8s. You know, it was just crimp rails up a 20 degree angle.
Yeah, every day was Christmas Day at Kelsey Garage.
Yeah. But it hadn't been that much longer before, because you introduced me, because obviously I lived in London with you, and you also introduced me to climbing in the Old Arch.
In the Old Arch, yes. And I'm so glad that's where I introduced you to climbing, because that's where, it's not where I started climbing. I started climbing for the very first time in Oxford, but it's where I became, you know, totally obsessed with climbing, because I moved into university halls. I turned up to university halls as another side note. This is going to be a useless podcast filled with tangents and rambles. But I turned up to university. I thought it'd be really cool to turn up without any stuff, and I thought that's kind of what everyone would do. And it turned out that's not what everyone would do. I will always remember the sight of people like with their like big trolleys of stuff turning up at university halls, and I had a bag with about four t-shirts in it, and as including the many, many things I forgot was my phone charger and laptop. So I didn't really have anything with me, so I ended up just, I did have my climbing shoes. So there's
that
an indication.
Doesn't surprise me that you remember those.
There's an indication. And I walked, I just ended up being like, well, I guess I'm screwed now, and just walked around the halls. And the first place I saw, no idea it was there, was the old original arch, which was a bouldering only wall, which was quite rare at the time.
Yeah.
In central London. And I basically was like, this is my personality now. I'm gonna live here. I'm gonna spend more time here than at that halls where I've forgotten all my stuff and everyone thinks I'm really antisocial.
I think you're really woke and don't have phones or laptops.
Well, I don't know about woke, but definitely weird.
We had a lot of good memories there.
Yeah, and so really glad that I did introduce you there, because I've got so many fond memories of that place.
Yeah. I mean, I said it was, I just wanted to talk about quickly my first ever experience of climbing. I'd gone a couple of times, but my first ever time going to the arch with you, and I'd said already, look, I'm not really into it. I don't really want to go, because I know there'll be people going a bit crazy, you know, taking it too seriously, and I'm not very good. I'm not really up for it. And he said, no, everyone's really chill. It's all good. Come on in. And I walk through the doors, and the first thing I see is a chap called Joe, who must be about 6'4", ripped up to the nines, doing one-armers on his left arm, holding like a 10-kilo weight, screaming at the top of his lungs.
Yeah. Yeah. that was Big Joe Rouge. He would shout more when he was successfully climbing something. And we always thought it was like a way of getting everyone to like watch him. He used to like loudly like smash his shirt into the holds. But he was big, and he was absolutely shredded. Yeah,
I've never seen something more impressive than him doing one-armers holding it, because he was so big. But yeah, and for some reason from there, you know, I fell in love with it. I remember going home. I couldn't even squeeze a shampoo bottle, but I got up my first V2. So
yeah, what a day.
Okay. Forward 5 years, maybe. Yeah, probably would be 5 years.
Yeah. I don't know about the gap there, but okay. So we had that chat, the famous Clio chat. Yeah. How long after that did we actually start taking it seriously? Do you remember?
Yeah, pretty quickly. And I think it was because we sort of just took it one hurdle at a time. It was obviously an insurmountable task. I think actually, if we both knew how much work it was going to be, it would have probably daunted us a lot more than it did. But because neither of us had ever run a facility, worked in leisure, worked even in an event, we might have understood a bit more about what sort of task this was. But instead, I think we just thought, well, okay, well, why don't we start with where? And I remember you drew up a very famous initial spreadsheet. And I think this spreadsheet, I wish we still had it, because it would show how much easier we had it in 2015 than anyone would today. Because yes, we looked at every city, you did, that didn't have a climbing facility that had over 100,000 people. Because I think we decided, not quite sure where the number came from, but we decided that a city could handle one climbing wall per 100,000 people.
So I don't know if that equation is still around, but I'm pretty sure I got that equation from Fred from the Arch, who also gave us a lot of help and advice at the start. Yes. He used to say that he thought that 100,000 people could support climbing walls. So if you've got a city, maybe you're listening at home and you'd love to open a climbing wall. If you've got a city that's got, you know, that number, if you divide the population by climbing walls, and if it comes out to over 100,000, then you're okay, supposedly.
Supposedly. I do think that number is a little bit off these days. I actually think 100,000 might be a little bit low. But
I think depending on the demographic, it could definitely be low.
Massively. And I think that's the problem. You know, Fred, obviously, bless him, was based in London, where the demographic is infinite. You've got absolutely, you know, the spectrum is huge. And he was the godfather of bouldering walls, you know, in London particularly.
Well, I mean, he certainly had... when the Arch was at its sort of highest, right, its heyday, I suppose, they at one point had like three massive climbing walls where no one else had more than one, I think.
Yeah, they were the first people adding multiples. Yeah. And you had the Arch, and then you had B1 next door, both with lines out the door.
Yeah.
They were the first people that I ever saw actually people queuing to go into a climbing wall. But this was before the real explosion of climbing.
I do remember that spreadsheet, but I also remember being really biased towards Coventry, because when I was at uni, my girlfriend at the time was a Warwick student. And so I used to go up there as a mad keen climber and see her. And they only had this uni wall, but I always remember that they had really psyched climbers, like the Warwick uni students particularly were really, really psyched, and they didn't have like a, you know, by that point I was used to big climbing walls in London and they had nothing, and I always remember that seemed like such a good opportunity.
And I disagreed massively, actually, for quite some time. I was living down in Cambridge and did not want to uproot my entire life to move to Coventry at the time, but you persisted. The business case was there, and you know, and eventually I acquiesced. But actually,
basically, you just didn't want to move to Coventry. That was the
And I had a partner at the time who also was very keen not to move to Coventry. And ultimately, one of us did, but you know, that's history. But actually, the reason we ended up going with Coventry wasn't that. It wasn't that we pinpointed Coventry and said, this is where we're going, all our eggs in this basket. It was actually the first place that returned us the right building. You know, I was calling estate agents all over the country. I think particularly down in the South Coast, I was looking a lot in Southampton, in Portsmouth, and then some northern, but Coventry was probably the most north we were really looking at the time. But we had a number of spots around the country that didn't have climbing walls that we were looking for. And I still remember talking to those estate agents, climbing was still so small
that
they laughed me out of town.
Yeah, yeah. It's like when we first spoke to bank manager, and he was like, what's all this climb? What's all this then? And I was like, what's bouldering? I was like, well, bouldering's like climbing, but instead of it being really high with ropes, it's matting and it's amazing. Anyone can go and take part, but it's only 4.5 meters high. And he went, yeah, I won't take off.
Won't take off. Won't take off. That's it.
He literally just looked me in the eye. I was like, nah. Not heard about that, mate. Not heard about that. More into football.
Yeah. Where's the next stadium? Yeah. The other phrase that really triggers me when people talk about it is they refer to it as climbing frames.
Oh God, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, if you end up owning a climbing wall and you want to be incredibly patronized by your relatives, be prepared for them to say, how's the climbing frame doing?
Which, particularly in the early days, happened a lot.
Yeah.
And I still get that from people who don't really know anything about climbing. It's like, yeah, you got climbing frames in there. It's like, yeah, especially a kid's playground.
Yeah, I think people who say that are in two camps. One who genuinely don't know what you're talking about, and the other part that just want to make you feel like a sad little man.
Yeah. We've definitely had people in our lives that have done that to us. Names.
But anyway, so that was... Yeah. So let's talk buildings, because...
Talk buildings, yeah.
Let's talk buildings, because if you're on the road to wanting to start a climbing wall, I think the mistake people sometimes make is that the hardest thing to get hold of will be the money and the capital. And actually the hardest thing is a good building. And this is really UK specific for this, because in other areas of the world it's much easier to get hold of a big bit of space, but England is a very densely populated and pretty small, geographically speaking, island. And so space is a premium here. So it's not easy to get a big space. So what are you looking for? What are you looking for when you go hunting, building hunting?
So the first thing is the size. So when I'm hunting, I don't want to see anything under 7,500 square foot.
What that is in square meters, just to give a...
Roughly 650, 700. You know, it's about, you know, 10 times. It's a little bit off that, but yeah, so...
That's the kind of... Yeah, okay.
That's about the ballpark. But the point, I think, when you go much smaller than that, and obviously around the world, there are, you know, look at Japan, there'll be plenty of walls a lot smaller than that. But in this country, and I think in a lot of, you know, European countries, you're not going to want to go too much smaller, or you just get very cramped. Particularly if you're choosing a city or a location that doesn't have much climbing, what you don't want to do is put a smaller wall in, flag to bigger climbing operators that it's a success, and they'll move in a bigger space, and it will, you know, hamper your operation. So I think the dream is about 10 to 12,000. You can keep going bigger and bigger and bigger, but I think that the sweet spot is around the 10 to 12,000. But that's the easy bit. There are loads of buildings that can tick that requirement. The ceiling height is the real sticking point. So the minimum that you're looking for is 5 meters in an ideal world. Now, obviously, it doesn't have to be the entire length of the building. There used to be 5 meters, but 5 meters, obviously, you've got 4.5 meter walls with 30 centimeters of matting. So, you know, you kind of want it to be 5 meters at an absolute minimum.
That's such a common mistake, isn't it? Is that people see the ceiling height and it's like 3.8 meters or something, and they think, oh, okay, well, it's short, but that's just about okay. And they forget about the matting. The matting takes off 30 centimeters. And even if you can go straight to the ceiling, suddenly you're talking about 3.5 meters, which is too short.
Yes. And then all of a sudden you're looking at, you know, because we do see people do it, and it's like, it's not impossible, but then your setting is really hampered, because obviously you can't have people like jumping for last moves if they're going to brain themselves on the ceiling. So 5.5 meters, preferably, you know, 6-7 meters is incredible. And that's the harder bit to find. Because even in big industrial spaces, quite often they just don't have enormous eave spaces. So that's the bit that I would say is more important.
Yeah, because they'll tell you Eve's height, won't they? But then if they tell you Eve's height, Eve's height is the sides, isn't it?
Eve's height is fine. It's if they say at the tallest point, it's 6
Yeah.
And it slopes down and it's complete weight.
It's not necessarily useful. Also, I guess, you know, you're looking for as much as a big box as you can. You don't want one that has maybe the space you want, but also sort of 11 function rooms and office spaces. Yeah. And those sort of places often do have those. And if they do, it's just going to be wasted space, really. You might be able to have like a party room, but it's not going to be making your money back, really.
Yeah, and ultimately, that's exactly the problem. You see this a lot with facilities that say, oh, we've got a gym, a yoga room, a party. You know, they have 9 different function rooms. None of them are actually generating any revenue. So actually, you've got a much bigger rent because you're taking on that space. Your service charge is higher. You know, a lot of your bills are quite focused around your size. And so you really don't want wasted space. I do think a party room is fantastic. And if you are going to be focusing on kids, maybe 2 party rooms. But in general, no, you really want your space to be climbing as much of it as possible and, to be useful space.
And going back to the point you made earlier, I just did want to reiterate that because I always think that every time I see it, the trick is to match the size of the climbing wall to the population that you're trying to serve with it. When I see like a really small little kind of alternative wall opening up in an area, which is like, basically a small town or, a town, I actually think that could work because it's small enough that the rent is low enough that it doesn't need to be getting more than sort of 60 odd people a day. And that's probably what it will get. So I always think like if you see a real small wall opening up, it might do well if it's in the right place. Yeah. And the same is true is that you see a massive wall opening up, but it's really well located, then again, it'll probably go well. But every now and then you see a large wall opening up in a town. And that's when I think, oh, okay. Well, I hope you've done a very good deal on the rent.
Yes. And this is as of yet, we have not seen in this country, please correct me if I'm wrong, people, but a big facility in a non-city survive and thrive. It has, the sport isn't yet big enough to have a really large facility in some, there's 20,000, 30,000 person town. Right.
Yeah, I guess the example for that is something like Icarathro, isn't it, in Scotland?
Yes,
near Edinburgh.
Just north of Edinburgh.
Which no, but it's massive. But I think it's had a few bailouts over the years.
Yeah.
And I think it gets some emails correcting me on this, but I think it gets some kind of government grants as well and subsidies. And it doesn't make money. It's so big and it's not that easy to get to.
But that's I think that your point there is the most important thing. If you're looking for buildings, think how people get to you and think about how most people access. Like in London, no one's driving. Everyone's using the tube. So, you need to be focusing on tube stops, trains, like train stations. And the same goes in cities, because city centre locations, both of our walls are slap bang in the middle of a city centre, which has massive pros and cons. You get a lot more footfall, great, but driving in, there's going to be a cost implication to it, for car parking, because neither of our facilities have their own car parks, which you can make arguments for and against, essentially.
That's the big drawback, if you're in the city centre, the pro, as you say, is that some people will be there anyway, or they can double up coming for a climb with, getting some stuff from shops and things, or other leisure, or mid-range Italian restauranting,
if any are left.
But yes, the downside, and it is a bad downside, is that people will have to pay for parking, which adds essentially, raises the cost of climbing at your wall, which is not ideal.
It's really difficult. And I think the next point to talk about is the rent, because the one thing we have seen a huge inflation on over the last few years is rent costs. So, lots of people say, well, the ideal is an out-of-town retail park. And I completely agree. In principle, that's a fantastic location for a climbing wall. You've got the massive car parks. You've got other shops and restaurants.
Yeah, best of both worlds, don't you, in theory?
Don't have the traffic even. The traffic should be better for the out-of-town retail parks. But the cost of these rents at the moment we're seeing is just probably 3 times higher than what we've ever seen before. And I don't really know, you know, what to say about that. Landlords, in my opinion, just haven't quite adjusted for the future of what, you know, these retail parks. We know.
Yes. Yeah. So basically, high rent. And what would you say is the general outlook of landowners? Oh, because yeah, it's also worth mentioning, because some people probably wouldn't. I don't think almost any climbing walls own their own space. I think the Castle might now own their own space. I think Oakwood might own their own space, but the vast majority are renting. So yeah. What's the general feeling at the moment for landlords when leisure operators, including, so that includes us and other indoor leisure-based activities, what are they thinking when the leisure operator comes knocking at the minute?
Bring. I've talked to a lot of landlords, you know, over the last few years. They're not keen. They are not keen. And COVID really has punctured the lung of the leisure industry when it comes to new builds. Because at the moment, they've got industrial warehousing and storage. Those are growing. There's a real growth industries at the moment, you know, backing up on all the online businesses that are built over COVID. And leisure, obviously, went 18 months, you know, going cap in hand to landlords, begging for rent, you know, rent reductions, that's the word. Whereas these businesses have grown and started paying much bigger rents. So yeah, sadly, this will come back, you know, this will repair, but just at the moment, we're still living in the post-COVID cloud, and landlords are very aware of that.
I would say, yeah, right now, the landlords would probably be most keen, if you can find the right space, would be a former retail option.
Yeah.
Because Jeff Bezos is changing the world, and mostly for the bad. You know, retail's dying off because everyone's shopping online, but because everyone's shopping online, then Amazon needs to get hold of as many big spaces that could have been climbing walls to just fill with stuff to operate everyone buying stuff online. So now all landlords want Amazon distribution. They pay more, and they'll probably be there, you know, as long as they can be. And they don't need much stuff. They don't need heating. They don't need much, you know, toilets and amenities and stuff. They basically just need a big box. So yeah, landlords are absolutely, yeah.
They're creaming it.
That's what they want. They want Uncle Jeff to come knocking. Yeah. They don't want, you know, you and I knocking on the door and asking for a leisure opportunity at the moment. Again, this is British. I bet some of this carries over, though, because I imagine everywhere.
I thought it would, because I imagine also just the concept of online retailers, that will be across the world. You know, that really won't be just, you know, and leisure will have suffered across the world. So, yeah. So sadly, you know, this is not a, don't be pessimistic. It will change, because particularly in retail, as Sam mentioned, the people you want to go and be talking to are the large mall owners who've got these huge amount of shops now that are just being bricked up because no one wants them. And there are some very large spaces. You know, our one in Leicester is part of the Highgrass, a big shopping center in Leicester. You know, these spaces do exist, and they are struggling to fill them back up with retail. So that is maybe a growth area where they can't just turn that into a storage unit.
Yes. Yeah. I think city center locations are going to be much more keen for climbing walls to fill their empty units and broken dreams. sorry, we might have had a few difficult conversations with mall owning landlords over the years. Although I very sorry to say, they've now gone into administration. Possibly because of their draconian rules on people accessing some of their empty, disused spaces. But that's another story for another time.
Yes. But still, pour a glass out for them, because.
Yeah. No thanks. So you got looking for a building.
Yeah.
What haven't we covered about buildings? You said briefly about making sure there's access, be it public or parking, if parking's more appropriate.
Planning permission is also the big one.
Planning permission, yes. Yes. What is the state of play on planning permission at the minute?
I've got good news for you. It's actually improved significantly. I'm not going to go too much into the sort of nitty gritty of what the numbers are, but essentially pre-COVID, leisure had its own certification that you had to get. So when we got the ballroom, we had to convert it to what was then D2. Mm. And that was basically it had to go from being a hotel to then becoming a leisure facility, which, you know, anyone that's dealt with local councils, it's a really drawn out affair. You get asked a lot of questions that are all pointless, and it's just very difficult and quite expensive. Whereas now...
Yeah, one of the problems at the time was that D2 also included nightclubs. Do you remember? So once they convert you to D2, technically you could then sell your lease to a nightclub owner.
Yeah, which obviously we were very tempted to do. But the good news is what they've done now is they've actually wrapped up a lot of light industry in with D2. So D2's gone. So basically leisure now includes light industrial. So
I wonder if that will make it a lot easier then to get into those light industry parks where you would
be easier.
That's interesting because, it always used to be the case that if it was a big industrial park or something, if there was no other leisure units in the park, you were probably pretty unlikely to get planning permission. But if it was already mixed use, so there was one already, then it was basically a cinch, wasn't it, really?
It's that. It's also the landlord, because obviously if you go to the landlord and say, hey, I'm a leisure operator, I'm going to convert this to D2, maybe fail and then go away again, and you're going to be left with a unit that's now a leisure unit on the middle of your industrial estate, which you can't do anything with because the council have said, well, no, we've promised everyone's going to be a leisure facility. Now I'm afraid.
Yeah, extra risk.
You can't just jump backs and forwards as easily as I think people would hope.
So the landlords take that as an extra risk. Again, to be less keen. But okay, so it sounds like it is now actually a bit easier potentially to go onto those sites, that's something and something to look at. But I would say those non-mixed use sites, and you see some walls going onto those, because I mean it does happen, but they tend to have the problem that they're not very well serviced with parking because obviously it's only supposed to have like four or five people working in the factory tops. So they've only got four or five car parking spaces, not sort of 40 or 50 like you might.
That you actually need. The other interesting point that we don't think we've ever actually had to debate this, but we have had a number of buildings with it that we've looked at. And that is a security guard. So you have to drive up and go through a barrier to get onto the industrial estate. And I've never quite managed to work out in my head whether that's a good thing or not. I mean, it's obviously not a good thing, but whether it be a hard no or not. But lots of them will have, you know, specific security, not letting anyone wander in, which I think could hamper a leisure offering.
And I bet they're not keen at the prospect of like a couple of hundred more people coming in a day when they're used to like 50 over the course of the day.
Over the entire day. So this is something you'll see a lot more of on industrial only estates that then maybe let you take a leisure unit. It's a small point, but it's something that has come up a few times.
Okay, so let's go back then, back in time to 2016, when the very first building we viewed.
Yes.
And we had an amazing estate agent called Nick.
Yeah,
he was the kind of guy. He had the classic estate agent suit, and you know what that means. But he had long hair and a goatee, didn't he?
He did. He's a former punk rocker, I seem to remember.
So he's not fooling anyone. You can tell he's rock and roll through and through.
He knew. the suit wasn't fooling anyone.
Yeah,
it was his knowledge about real estate. No, it was amazing. I remember because I had called up so many estate agents and had the cold shoulder from all of them just okay, mate, we'll put you on a list and get back to you if anything pops up, and none of them had. And I called up Holt Real Estate, and someone just said, no, we've got nothing, as everyone had, but they said maybe my colleague might have something. And so we traveled. Did I actually not go to the first viewing?
You didn't. And I think it was because they had a restaurant that had just fallen through, hadn't it?
It did. It was one of those ones. What is it?
Buffet, all you can eat buffet.
All you can eat buffet affair. Yeah. They'd actually dug a hole in the floor and put a lift shaft in they actually had gone quite a long way down the lease negotiations. You know, they'd actually done some work, which they kept talking to us about.
But very fortunately for us, like their lift, it went nowhere. And I'm here all week. And they just bailed. So yeah, we went up to view, and it was actually, and God, we must have thought things were so easy back then, because that was the very first building we went to see.
Yeah.
And you weren't there. So I went up with our dad. And I remember feeling just like a fish out of water completely. Just like, you know, I was really young. I was only about 24 at the time. Mm. And I felt really young.
Yeah.
And I honestly, I think if Dad hadn't been there to give me sort of like a bit of extra gravitas and importance, then Nick probably just would have never returned our phone calls, because it would have just felt like a complete joke. I didn't really know what I was looking for. I sort of like ghosted around being like, yeah, I imagine an overhang here. And maybe this is the slab section, perhaps, you know, like I didn't have a clue what to ask, which is probably quite good, because I don't think Nick had a clue what to say. So
No, I don't think he would have answered many of the questions. Now, again, there is a video, which I don't know whether you still have, but obviously you took a walk around video of that building. Now, it's hard to describe to people how derelict the ballroom was when we walked around it. And
what is the ballroom? What is the ballroom for everyone who doesn't know?
Oh, sorry. Yeah. So the ballroom obviously was. So back in the swinging 60s, the Lear Frick Hotel was the landmark destination in Coventry. It drew people from all over the country. People performed on the stage. The two Ronnies, I want to say, but you know, there were some big names.
I think it was Morecambe and Wise. But
Morecambe and Wise.
Yeah. I've recently been to the town of Morecambe, and they're still leaning quite heavily on Morecambe for Morecambe and Wise, and I found the whole thing quite tragic.
That's a shame, but luckily we haven't had to try.
Oh, Sex Pistols.
Sex Pistols, because I have a feeling that the Johnny Rotten throwing his TV out of the window was actually in the Lear Frick Hotel.
Yes, it was. Market. Yeah.
But anyway, so we the ballroom was the ballroom of the Lear Frick Hotel. Now
defunct.
Yes. So now
was it still a travel lodge at the time?
It was a travel lodge, because a little bit of a, you know, a little snippet of history for the viewers. I travelled to Coventry only once as a university student for a university poker tournament, and I stayed in the travel lodge that was the Lear Frick Hotel.
Wow.
Which was quite amazing coming back to it. Obviously, I had completely blanked that from my memory, and then walking in, it all came flooding back. But I think it was in the midst of being converted from a failed travel lodge. So it failed as a Lear Frick Hotel, failed as a travel lodge, and was then being converted into student accommodation. And luckily for us, they tried everything. Obviously, they couldn't convert the ballroom section into student accommodation for whatever reason. Just wasn't laid out correctly.
So the whole time it had been a travel lodge, they'd just mothballed it. So they just locked the doors to the ballroom and just ignored it and pretended it wasn't there. And over that time, some local hoodlums, youths, skivvies, had evidently broken in. And there was all kinds of graffiti and stuff around. Yeah. They'd trashed anything that was in there. Yeah. And so it really was a state when we
and a football.
Yeah.
It was a mess. It was a total mess. And I think the thing is, again, I'd like to reiterate to people how little we knew, not only about running a facility, but about renovating one. Costs involved. We hadn't got the first clue of what's going in. But the only thing is, we went in, and I wanted another little story as well, just to show how green I was. It was, I think, the second meeting, Sam wasn't there. And I went up with, again, our dad. And I obviously came from the city, so put a suit on every day. I remember getting ready with dad at home, and he was just putting on jeans and t-shirt. And I was like, Dad, no, come on, you got to look serious. Mm-hmm. No, you know, you need to be taken seriously. It's really embarrassing. Put a suit on. Put a proper, come on, dress properly.
Yeah, come on, Dad. You're only carrying this whole thing on your shoulders. Yeah,
exactly. If you don't look credible, then none of us do. So I, you know, dressed up to the nines, you know, looked, you know, I was 26, 27, you know, not much older than you were, but knew that to be taken seriously, dressed to impress.
And dress for the job you want, not the job you have. And you want the job of man with lease.
Man with lease. And I didn't have lease. So got dad to put a shirt on. Don't think the full suit went on, but the shirt went on. Turned up to meet the landlord. And I will never forget walking in to shake the landlord's hand. He was in basketball shorts, trainers, t-shirt. And I've never felt more out of place. And I realized in that second, I hadn't got a clue what I was doing.
Yeah. You know? And I mean, you realized that within the first seconds of your first time at the ballroom, just like I did.
Yes.
So it really didn't take long at all. But it just goes to show how little interest they obviously had in that space. Because the landlord, for some reason, was taking these two absolute idiots seriously.
They never once asked for proof of funds. They never once asked to know what we were doing with the place.
They must have been in dire straits, to be honest. Yeah. But so we went in and they were interested. We explained the climbing concept. I think they were excited at the concept that we wouldn't have to put in heating.
Well, if you remember, we did actually suggest we'd like some heating, and they took one look with the contractor and said, no, if you want to heat it, you can pay for it.
Well, let's talk contractors, because what shortly happened after that is we had a meeting, just Ben and I, with someone that we thought was like a landlord character, but was actually just a contractor the landlord had put on. And his job was to try and price up how much renovations we were going to be asking for to see if the building was suitable. Anybody who was doing any kind of climbing wall anywhere, you would have to have the same chat. They need to know what we're asking them to put in, basically. And what did we think that was?
We thought everything. As it turned out, I think, because we didn't quite understand the cost of the price of tea in China or anything, in fact. We just went round every single room and told them, well, we want central heating, we want air conditioning, we want air extraction, we want everything to be completely done up to the nines.
Yeah, we were like, rip that out, put that in, take that out. You know, we'll have, you know, all this floor needs to be perfect. We were giving it everything, because I basically thought we were talking to a landlord, and I was so green that I thought they'd be so desperate for us to take this building off their hands that they would throw any money at it. And the guy who was a contractor, and so it was very much in his interest, he would have been thrilled to get this amount of work, but he stopped us, didn't he? The contractor stopped us and looked at us. And I remember he said, have you got carte blanche for this? And we said,
yes, sir. Thank you, sir.
Yep. Carte blanche. Yep. Think we do. Yeah.
Whatever we want, we get.
Yes, because we thought we were talking to like a lower manager of the building, and he was basically going to sign off on all this. And so we thought in the moment, the best way of doing that would be to sort of trick him into thinking that the senior guys had already signed all this off, mate. Yeah.
They said 1 to 3 million minimum they'll put in.
Yes. And so they took one look at that, and we almost lost the lease. Yeah. Didn't we?
Yeah, I actually had another sort of famous phone call with one of the owners at the time, who was actually one of the owners at the time, who called me up. Now, bearing in mind, Sam and I started Prior Walls Limited, which is obviously the name of our business, from a laptop out of his flat for £16, getting a disreputable website to set us up with a company number. That's what we were. That's all we were. And he called me up and said, right, either you're going to have to wind your neck in on some of these costs. You know, I understand you're a blue chip organization, but, you know, there is a limit. I obviously had to go away and Google what blue chip organization was. And I was very happy to see that Prior Walls Limited was up there with Amazon, Microsoft and Apple.
I wonder where the blue chip actually comes from. The etymology of that is.
I wish I did. I wish I did. All I do know is blue chip organization essentially means sort of Fortune 500.
One of the big guys. Yeah.
One of the big dogs, which we were.
Prior Walls Limited, not quite on that list.
Yeah, we hadn't quite floated on the stock exchange.
But what was great is because you didn't know what they were. When he goes, could go with a blue chip organization like yourself, like to be funny. And you go, yes, makes sense.
Well,
that's,
looking at us.
That's us. Any colour chip you want, mate. We've got it.
We can provide. And what was amazing at the time, every conversation we had with them was chipping away at this enormous figure. But the one thing, ultimately, we ended up with about £150,000 worth of work that the landlord did. And at the time, the two of us thought that's standard and we've probably been a little bit ripped off here. And as I've got older and talked to more landlords, I would say getting them to essentially completely renovate the building is not normal.
I'm actually staggered now how much we got.
Yes.
Obviously, the building was in a state of disrepair that meant it would have been unsaleable. But still, you know, in today's day and age, you will be asked to do the majority of that renovation work yourself.
Well, look at Leicester. You know, we were given the glass in the windows and it was a sandbox and we had to pay for everything else. And the landlord just laughed when I think anything else was suggested that they would do. They were very generous to put glass in the windows. But, you know, they did it. You know, the ballroom did it. Now, we had a lot of very interesting conversations with the actual contractors. I don't want to say too much because I wouldn't want them to come after us, but they are actually, they've gone into liquidation, which isn't particularly surprising. I'll tell the one story that was always stuck with me on the caliber of their work was our lift. So we did have our own lift put in. Just so we could ferry people up because it is up three flights of stairs, the ballroom. And after about 3-4 months, it was leaking. So there was water coming into it at the bottom. So we had a chap come up and take a look at it. And it's fair to say he almost died because he walked out onto the roof, looked at where the lift was and thought, great, I'll just start investigating the roof, put 1 foot onto the roof where the lift was and put his boot straight through the roof. Because it turned out that instead of putting a roof over the lift, they had simply put a tarpaulin.
Yes, nice. That's good. That would have held probably for...
It would have held if no one had walked on it.
Judging by our landlord, that would have been considered a long-term solution.
A long-term solution.
And let's also... And this one isn't anything... This isn't going to carry over to any other building ever, but it has to be said... That we live, we reside in one of the strangest buildings ever built.
Yeah.
Anything can happen in our building. When we walked through the back of ours, and there's sort of a student accommodation, but there's also just sort of like rooms of nothing. We found rooms that are just boarded up, and the only way in was through a broken skylight in its ceiling, but it was just boarded up, gone. Don't know why. We found a room which appeared to have someone residing in it.
Yes.
Yeah.
I don't think he was paying rent.
No.
So the door he was using was actually a mattress. So. Yeah.
Yes. Yes. I say a room. We found a mattress fort in a room, and within that mattress fort was evidence that a man was living. Just in our building.
Yeah.
Wasn't really our problem, so we didn't do anything. We put his mattress back up and left him alone, didn't
let
we?
Him be.
But yeah, not the sort of thing you'd expect to find within a commercial building. But also, our landlord found some ultimate cowboys to work with us.
Yeah.
And one of the classic stories that we'll never forget was when we had to get out onto the roof, didn't we? I can't remember what we were doing on the roof.
Well, the roof was always in constant need of repair.
Yeah,
so
yeah, roof probably had a massive roof probably had a massive hole in it. But anyway, we needed to get out onto the roof, and the contractor we had just opened a student's bedroom. Thankfully, they weren't in it at the time, and just walked in with muddy boots, and everything, and just said, "Come on, lads, come follow me." And we were just standing in this poor person's bedroom. Who must have been a paying?
Oh yes, this wasn't another fort.
This wasn't a mattress fort. Although some of those bedrooms are a little more than mattress forts, but we were just in there, and then he took her cutlery, bent it, and started using it to jimmy open the window. And just smash the window open so we could get onto the. And the whole time he was just like, "Yeah, follow me, lads!" Like he knew what he was doing.
And I think at the time, because obviously we weren't responsible for him or the building, it seemed extremely surreal. And I think, but for some reason, it seemed normal. But looking back on it, no, this man was just the ultimate yes man who was willing.
He was the ultimate yes man, and the fact that he just thought everything was no problem. The point when he was bending that poor girl's cutlery to make a sort of lock pick. what even was this? Some sort of like inner city Coventry Skyrim with but anyway, and I remember actually going and just standing in the hallway because I was like, if this person comes back. I could go to jail for this. Like,
there's no defense.
This has got to be criminal. I remember just going and standing in the hallway with my head in my hands, basically being like, any moment she's going to come back. She's going to be screaming. The police are going to be here. but that was the caliber of the building.
Yeah, and that was the caliber of people we were working with. And we worked with that gentleman on another. He became our contractor for a short time.
Oh, God. What were we thinking?
I don't know what we were thinking. I think we were thinking he was cheap. And I think it's fair to say that when we sort of first opened the Borum, our budgets had been run very dry. So when we needed work doing, and there's a yes man that says he can do it for cheap, it's great.
So what we were doing is we had this big space that was actually big enough to put some more climbing into, but they put a suspended ceiling in it. Yes. And that suspended ceiling, so it's just plasterboard, but it lowered the ceiling height to too low. So we basically needed that removing. That was all we needed. We thought, let's call back the biggest cowboy the world's ever seen because he'll be cheap. And also because, you know, you call him up and say, mate, I need a NASA rocket to take me to the moon. He'll be like, sweet, 100 quid.
Tuesday?
100 quid. I'll sort that for you, pal. Like, there's a nice thing about calling him because no job was too much.
No.
He couldn't do any job, but, but he could make, I mean, you wouldn't get that guy to mow your lawn, but
not twice.
But his sort of attitude would be so sort of refreshing up until the point you try to do the job. But anyway, he came in to raise that ceiling height and he drilled through, he took down the plasterboard, then drilled through to the actual plaster, and the whole lot fell down. It was an absolute collapse. It just fell, the whole thing, or this, of course, this whole room fell down. It made absolute, it was bedlam. Basically just caved the ceiling in.
The entire room.
And then we had another of the most surreal conversations of my life. Do you remember going in there and be like, well, I'm not clearing that up.
And we were standing on about a meter's worth of rubble that was our perfectly serviceable ceiling before he drilled it off.
We were standing in the ruins of our building. And he was going, you haven't paid me to sort that out.
And the issue we had was he had managed to do something very clever. He had actually... we had employed him. He was our contact. He was our contractor. But he had then employed some even more Yahoo people to then come and do the work. So when we said, look, I'm sorry, this has happened. He said, well, I didn't do it. It's like,
yes, that was the amazing bit. He pointed to the bloke he'd just hired to do the job for him and went, well, he did it. It's not my problem.
Not my problem. So we were left, and he did. We've had this many times over our career of the Borum owning. We were backed into a corner because we either paid him to clear the mess up that he had created, or he was going to walk off site, and we were then going to be left with just enough hardcore rubble to, you know, build another Borum.
Yeah, it was. I remember that as an absolute disaster. We ended up having to pay him more money to incredibly badly finish the job that he had already started and ruined. So, thus proves the old saying: buy cheap, you buy twice.
By twice, and actually by thrice. My favorite actual ending to that story is when he said, don't worry, the kid that did the drilling, he's also an electrician.
Yes, of course he is, yeah.
I thought, okay.
He wasn't a roofer either or anything.
No, he wasn't anything. I said, that's fantastic, Will, because actually we need some lighting in here because it's quite dark. He said, not a problem. He will sort that for you. And I came back in half a day later to find a man who had strung together some sort of spotlights But the wires, he hadn't, you know, put any trunking in or anything. He just let them hang. And when I said, sorry, Will, the wires are just hanging loose. Like, I've never seen that on any sort of, you know, professional in
yeah, you don't see that in Nando's, do you?
And he said, oh, right, if you're going to be picky, fine, I'll get him to sort it. So I thought, fair enough, Will's going to get him to sort it. He'll go and get some trunking, put it in trunking, and it'll be a nice, clean look. It's not what I got. Came back to find a man who had, he had gone out and invested in some clothing hooks, which he then screwed to the ceiling. And then he just like put the wire on the ceiling hook. So technically it wasn't hanging down anymore.
They would do that, wouldn't they?
Up to any sort of code.
They would do that sort of thing and you'd just be left there like, they would talk to you like you were the insane one. Yes. And it was like living in this weird dream world where people just did the worst stupid rubbish and then looked at you like, that's standard.
I've literally
just done that for M&S.
The phrase that Will would throw at me all the time was, don't you be telling me how to suck eggs. I was like,
yeah,
I'm not sure how you're sucking eggs, Will, but if you were sucking eggs in front of me, I'm sure I would be commenting on how you are sucking these eggs.
He would be sucking it as well, because he also famously had no teeth.
No teeth at all. There were a lot of red flags with him.
There were a lot of red flags. He was a man who obviously couldn't afford dental treatment.
Yeah.
And I think when you look back on it now, there are many stories about us starting the ballroom, which goes to show how unbelievably inept we were.
Yeah.
But also, you have to bear in mind, we had no money.
Yeah.
So it was this desperation to try and get stuff done. And you get what you pay for in life.
Yeah.
And the only man we could afford is a man that was going to ruin the job.
And we knew it. We knew it going in.
We
knew it was never going to look perfect, but sadly, it never even looked half decent.
But of course it didn't. And in fact, that ceiling in that area is still pretty poor.
It is.
We did eventually get a guy to put in some better lighting and put some proper trunking in, but it still is pretty naff. Anyway, I can't think of any other, there are obviously other stories of Will being a complete disaster case, but
if you want one more, I'll give you one more that I can think of. And this was the fallout between our landlord, who's also using Will as a contractor. And there was obviously some issue over payment, which, you know, someone hadn't been paid. And I remember we got to the wall, we opened up, and our first door we come to is our lift door, which is being used for storage, and it was hanging off its hinges. And I thought, dear Lord, we've been robbed, because like, all the stuff was gone. So I remember I called Will up and Will just said, oh, sorry about that. Yeah, I hadn't been paid. So I decided to break in and just kick your door in and take some of my stuff and leave.
And it was like, well, that wasn't there because we're renting this space, Will. So that was essentially ours. And he's just like, all right, cool. Well, hopefully see you Monday. See you, mate.
Yeah.
He was the sort of guy you could have a screaming, shouting match with and call each other every name under the sun. And then 5 minutes later, be like, oh, you're right, Ben, how's it going, pal?
Every time. He was so used to these, aggressive interactions, which we weren't. You know, we're not confrontational people, and we had not dealt with these people much before. We're a bit better now, but
it was an amazing defense, basically, wasn't it? It was a defense mechanism, because he knew, I'm going to go in, do a terrible job. They're going to go, hang on, Will, this isn't very good. And I'm just going to scream at them, be like, that's amazing. That's industry standard.
That's what you paid for.
Yeah. And to be fair, that was what we paid for. Because that is what us and our landlord must have had in common, is that we were trying to do stuff on the cheap.
On the cheap.
But let's wind forward a bit now. And let's talk opening. Okay. So somehow we've barreled ourselves into a situation where we are actually opening.
Yeah.
I don't remember how rushed it was when we set. And I remember setting an opening date. Which was April 29th. And that was April 29th, 2017 was the opening date.
Yeah.
And I remember feeling just awful, really.
Neither of us had a clue what was about to happen. you know, we had a few issues, notably that obviously we had a Rockgen Pro. We had a POS system that none of us had used before. So we didn't really know what that was about. We hadn't paid for any marketing, I don't think. So we had put some stuff up on UKC.
Which got taken down.
Which did get removed because apparently we hadn't paid for it. That's a good point.
We had put stuff up on
Facebook, and we had put up stuff on Instagram, you know, discussing the build, but we hadn't paid for anything. So we didn't really know if anyone knew we existed.
there was a bit of word of mouth, wasn't there? And we had like a Facebook page that some people had joined at the time, but
And we had some staff members joining who were from the universities who then obviously could tell some students, but it was all very word of mouthy. You know, we hadn't put a fortune into a marketing campaign thinking, okay, great, we're going to get a few hundred people from this.
Yes. I mean, by this point, we've hired a team of people. And I think our very first interview is the perfect one to sum that phase up. I realize that over the course of this podcast, we are just going to sound like a pair of absolute like idiots. But we also couldn't do that. We were rubbish at that, add that to the list. And our very first interview was with a chap who still works for us. So it worked out in the end.
It has worked really well.
But we went to interview this guy. We took him to a coffee shop because the state of the ballroom was just abysmal at the time.
Untenable.
We took him to a coffee shop and we had all these ideas about the sort of questions we should ask him. And I'm pretty sure basically the first question was, when can you start? What hours can you do?
Yeah, because Tim, we will say his name Tim, because Tim is now our center manager at the ballroom and has risen the ranks really well and has sort of really grown into, you know, an amazing staff member. But I think it's fair to say he was very shy in that first interview. So I think we did a lot of talking, and that talking was essentially saying, do you want the job? When can you start?
I imagine when you get drafted into a cult, it works out much the same way. You think you're get joining into like a pyramid selling or something where like it sounds like a proper job, but then when you turn up, it's just two blokes in fleeces in a coffee shop offering you a job.
And you know, again, we shouldn't say this stuff really because it doesn't make us look great, but when we started, we didn't know what HR was. We didn't know, you know, I'm happy to say we never didn't pay anyone. But, you know, contracts were a little bit limited, thin on the ground, let's say. But, you know, we did our best and everything was in the right spirit. And we, you know, we left from the front. We were there 7 days a week.
Yes.
To make this thing work.
Yes. So that is something we did do. We were present for every hour that it was open.
Yeah.
For, well, I don't know, 4 or 5 months, maybe 6 months.
I will give a shout out to my lovely wife Mel, who I remember I made. She at the time wasn't living in Coventry, and I did make her cry, because I think about 3 or 4 months in, she came up and she was coming up all the time. I wasn't traveling because I was working every day, and I remember we were sat on the matting, and I said I could do this forever. And I think in my head, I was obviously in the sort of honeymoon phase of, you know, I was knackered, but it was doing something I wanted to do. And I hadn't quite put two and two together that actually what I was doing was quite difficult to then maintain a relationship with.
Yes. What you're essentially saying is, I could do this forever. I could never see you ever again and just live my whole life in this climbing wall.
But she stuck it out. She stuck it out. And I'm very happy to say she did. But yeah, I think that was quite a good wake up moment. Because both of us hit the buffers at some point.
You know, we actually, it was really dramatic. The ending of that process of, I just remember about dramatic. We forgot to tell the fantastic story in the car when we drove up.
We have to tell that story.
We have to tell that story. So quickly rewinding, there was a time, this is just to show the level of stress that we had. Yeah. Ben and I have always been incredibly close. So we grew up on a farm, so we didn't have a lot of options with, you know, hanging out with people outside of school. And we always spent all our time together. So we've always been incredibly close. So we've never had a problem running businesses together, because we always felt that our relationship as brothers is more important than money. So we would never let anything to do with money get in the way of that. I would rather give Ben all of my shares than have us fall out.
Verbal contract.
Yeah. but anyway, that's just for backdrop. The level of stress we were under. We were driving up to have a meeting with the landlord where he had basically rug pulled us and said, he had basically said that they were basically having doubts, weren't they? And they were thinking about basically pulling out.
They'd just called us up and we thought we were basically going up to sign a contract and get this process moving. And they said, yeah, we're going to have to go another direction. We need to have a chat with you on site. We're done. And we don't think we can continue like with you guys.
And at this point, we've both left our jobs. So, and we actually did that very prematurely, thinking it would be quicker than it was. But we'd both left our jobs. And suddenly our landlord was basically talking about pulling the rope from us. So we were under so much stress. And to show that, we had the biggest argument, the biggest blowout shouting argument we've ever had on that drive up there. And what was it about?
It was a real doozy. You know, I've never yelled at you more. And I stand by my position in this argument, for the record.
I actually think you were right. Yes. I concede my position, I think, now.
But the position was this. I suggested that Durham University, a university that I never attended.
Nor did I.
Rejected my application within 15 minutes of application.
With regret.
With regret. Turns out they didn't want me. But I suggested that they were a more impressive institution than Warwick University.
Which was the local to Coventry. So
Coventry. Sam's girlfriend at the time obviously did attend Warwick University. So that was
ex-girlfriend by that point.
Yep, that's at the point. Okay, so X at that time. So essentially, our connections to universities were Sam had climbed at Warwick University a couple of times, never attended, and I had never set foot at Durham. But we argued so aggressively that each one was actually the better institution. That you would have thought that we actually invented them and we were the founding.
And we were screaming at each other about it. Yeah. We've never done that, really. We've never done that before or since.
No.
And we weren't able to realise that we weren't arguing about universities. No. This was just us venting our rage, but we couldn't figure it out at the time. No. We were just yelling at each other. And as you say, we were defending the wrong universities. You were defending a university that rejected you. And I was defending a university that really rejected me, because I spent time hanging out with my girlfriend at the time at Warwick and was pretty roundly rejected by her friends as this weird climbing guy who just wasn't like them. I didn't want to kind of do what stuff they wanted to do. I just talked about climbing all the time. I wanted to go climbing. And they thought I was an absolute weirdo. And so really, I felt pretty rejected by Warwick and you felt pretty rejected by Durham. And yet we were
so aggressive.
Yeah. But that just, I think it's just a funny story, because it just demonstrates the level of stress we were under.
Yeah.
But okay. So we've gone back there. We've hired Tim, given him a job in the room. We also hired Francis. Who was so Francis Bensley was has also been on this podcast, and she was our manager for sort of 5 years or so.
Well, we had to give a shout out to Francis, because she was hired as our assistant manager.
Yes,
at a time when that meant that on shift would be Sam and I and Francis. And so the title of assistant manager, it really was assistant to the manager.
Yeah, exactly.
She grinned and bared it, she put up with it. And, obviously as time went by and we stepped back, she did become the manager and ran the place really well. But in those opening 6 months, definitely that was a title in all but,
Only
a name.
Thankfully for us, Francis is and was a sweetheart and had a very good work ethic and was somehow willing to put up with our rubbish for all that time.
I've just thought, if you wanted another story to typify some stress, Sam will appreciate this one. It's because I flew off the handle. So I was obviously, one of my
Speakers.
It's the speakers. So I was in charge with, quite a lot of the random bits and pieces just to try and sort out for the wall while Sam was sorting the holes in the setting. So speakers was one of those things. And I had organized a set of speakers to be delivered. And I got a phone call maybe a week before we were due to open, with this poor chap calling up, where I had written, to be fair, in my defense, they hadn't delivered them. And then I had looked up the delivering instructions and then they had then said they're out of stock. So I had to call them and the guy was like, look, I'm really sorry, but we don't stock them anymore. You know, we're going to have to go in a different direction.
But he was willing to get a separate set of speakers to us by Monday.
By Monday. What was my reaction? See you in hell, son.
Yeah, you were livid. You were like, that's not good enough. Yeah. You need to get into me earlier. And I only pointed out to you afterwards that it was Friday. And I was listening to this conversation. I knew that it was just the stress. But I was like, wow, I've never heard Ben be this unreasonable. This guy cannot do anymore. No. Unless he like drives them here himself, which he's not going to do. Physically can't do any better.
I think the guy could have sacrificed his firstborn and I wouldn't have seen it as enough as an apology.
No, again, bless him. He's fallen foul of the fact that we were just absolutely at the end of our miserable rope at the time.
The only positive to that story was actually, ironically, the ones I had ordered and the ones he was going to replace them with would not have actually worked. And so I did manage to source some speakers that were better, potentially. So
yes, but back in those days, our surround sound speaker system was just a speaker or two at the desk, wasn't it?
They were worse than that because they were above the desk going down. So it meant that you could hear the music very loudly at the desk when we were trying to talk to people, not really anywhere else.
But now let's talk about, and this is something that you got to get over, and I'm sure any other wall owner listening to this will remember, well, most of them, maybe some of them have had a different experience, but most of them I'm sure will remember this early period, because remember what we didn't have very much of in the first sort of 2 or 3 months?
People.
Customers.
Well, I think one thing we sort of skirted over is our opening day.
Our opening day was a success.
It was. I think I'll happily give people the numbers. I think we had 82 people through.
I think we had 84.
84. Well, we won't let that descend into a Durham versus Warwick. But we had a number which, you know, we took good money because obviously every single person was new and, you know, didn't have membership. So, you know, we had an amazing day, and it was, I think, the best feeling of adrenaline I've ever had. Just all day talking to people. You know, the very first person that came up the stairs bought an annual membership. You know, I remember
the car machine then broke, and I was absolutely panicking, running around.
I remember we sent Dolly, your wife, off with him into the cafe with the card machine, just saying, "Make it work."
Yeah, we need this money, Dolly.
Yeah, like, this needs to go. And then about the fourth people that came through, a guy called Ruben, who still climbs a lot of the Borum, great guy. I remember him and James, one of his friends, they both came up, and they said, "Great, can we grab a couple of coffees?" And we said, absolutely, not a problem, as long as you can make them yourselves.
Well, they ended up making themselves because we couldn't figure out the coffee machine.
It turns out we bought a fancy coffee machine. I haven't got a clue how to use it.
I don't even know how this ended up happening, but the state of affairs was our customers started making their own coffees with the coffee machine.
I mean, we still charge them, obviously.
Yeah, well, we bloody need the money, didn't we? I mean,
it was a mess, but it worked. And I will never forget, you know, the day ending, we had lots of our family had all come up to support us that day. Everyone was helping clean up, you know, and it was, you know, so I think, our sister Katie was there. She had come up and she'd helped with lots of some of the artwork on the lockers. And, you know, everyone had really pitched in. And I remember thinking, this is amazing. You know, we have created a product that is just going to do amazing from day one. And, going home, high-fiving, thinking fantastic. Then, you know, we had a couple of hours sleep. We came back for the next day, the Sunday, opened up them shutters and just waited for the hordes to arrive. And
they didn't,
They did not.
And then we had a long downturn of wonder. I guess it was pretty bad because we opened right at the end of April.
Yeah.
And it was pretty bad all through the summer, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And I remember the low point for me personally was that first, we finally got to September.
Yeah.
And we had that first couple of weekends. And then the one I'd had in my calendar as the one that everything was going to turn around was the weekend that all of the students were going to be back. And I figured the students are all going to come back. They're going to move in and we're going to see the numbers just jump. Yeah. And I remember that Sunday of that weekend was the quietest weekend day I ever worked. Over the course of the whole day, we had 22 people. That is just unbelievable. And that when you're working in a place for sort of 8 hours, because I mean, I suppose we are at least open for a couple of hours less on a Sunday, but it was eight hours. That is a really long time of sitting by the desk and nobody coming up the stairs.
No, and it was always because I think initially we didn't even have CCTV or cameras or anything. So all sound, we'll be sat at the desk waiting and we'd hear, like, is it a customer?
Yeah, we'd hear footsteps. We'd hear footsteps. We'd be like, oh, a customer. A customer approaches. And then that customer would turn out to be like a delivery guy. And be like,
sorry. Council guy demanding money.
But, but I remember that Sunday, I walked out onto our roof and I looked down and the street was rammed with people. Yeah. It was really busy. It was a lovely day. It was really busy. And that was the only moment over the whole project that I was like, it's not worked.
Yeah.
We've lost everything. There's so many people down there. And yeah, I was watching them like walking past, looking at the sign and then just like walking on and probably imagining them like laughing, like, ha ha ha, those idiots trying to make a climbing wall in Coventry. That was the only moment that I thought we'd really blown it.
Yeah. And it's, I think that's the one thing I say for anyone starting any project, you know, doesn't matter what you're doing, but climbing wall is obviously the big one for us. It's not always going to be a fast success story. You know, you're not going to hit the ground running and just automatically get a load of customers. You know,
it goes to show how you can be so close to success and fail. Because if someone that day had offered me half of our money back to just pretend none of this had ever existed, I would have taken it.
Yeah.
Because that was the only day that I was like, yeah, it's not worked. We've humiliated ourselves. about 15 times over, outed ourselves as a couple of absolute incompetent buffoons, wasted loads of money. Everyone's just going to be throwing stuff at me. I'm a complete and utter failure. That was what that Sunday was like. And if you are interested in opening up a climbing wall, be prepared for a lot of self-doubt, stress, anxiety. That opening period is tough, and I've seen other people go through it, and I do always feel sorry for them. But the positive is, do you remember that October?
Big October.
We averaged about 100 people a day all of a sudden, and up until that point, we've been averaging like sort of 50 people. It was basically, it was just rubbish, and then suddenly that October just turned around, and then it just went up from there, and it finally did pick up. And that was incredible when it really started going. What could we have done better, do you think, in those opening days?
I think in those opening days, sadly, we'd have a better perspective on things. I know my personal perspective was, you know, we've done really well day one, therefore the graph has to go up or it's a disaster. You know, I think that's a mindset thing that I hadn't prepared myself for, that actually this is going to be a roller coaster of emotions, and, you know, and there's not so much you can do about it. So, you know, I think a mindset shift is big. We also probably should have had more money in the budget for marketing.
Ultimately,
you know, I think it was quite unbelievably blind of us to think that people would know what a climbing wall is. You know, even back then, there wasn't a climbing wall in Coventry. So, you know, you've got all these people walking past us, you know, it's got a big monkey head on a wall. I think we just assumed people would know what that is and come up the stairs and give us money and have fun.
The downside for us is we had footfall outside of the door, but we also had three flights of stairs. So that kind of put people off. We were so broke, though. I think that's the thing, looking back on it, is that we just had no money. So I think that would have been tough, is how to do things differently. But I think also, just for posterity, do you remember the state of our house that we were living in? So Ben and I were working 7 days a week until basically early till late. So we were spending almost no time at home. Our house consisted of two faux leather, non-matching Parker Lounger type lazy boys.
Yeah.
And in front of sort of a, you know, a very small little television. And when we get home, we were so tired that we'd put on Freeview and we ended up watching Bullseye.
A lot of Bullseye.
Can't be a bit of bully.
And a lot of Chris Tarrant, not a millionaire.
We do like quiz shows, but I don't like darts. and the questions from Bully were mostly around that sort of like 1980s or 1970s. Yeah. I don't even know when it was filmed. It was ancient.
I don't think we were actually answering any questions.
But pop culture for that is was not the one. We couldn't answer any of the questions. But I remember just being so tired.
Yeah.
I was too tired to get up. Yeah. And so we ended up watching Bullseye until like 2 a.m. in the morning. Most nights. And I think, looking back on it, that was one of the big mistakes. Because, yes, we had no money. So we were desperate to keep the staff bills low.
Yeah.
But I really think we should have been doing solo opens for a couple of hours because we were only lived round the corner.
Yeah.
So if something had gone wrong, we could have called the other one.
Yeah.
But we were both so tired that we weren't thinking like, you know, how can we change our strategy to get more people in? We were literally just thinking about how can I get through the day?
Yes. Stay awake.
Yeah. We just didn't have any brain space left, did we?
No, and I think we're actually very lucky we didn't experience burnout sooner, because that's a big thing. Burnout is real, and we did both experience burnout after probably about 6 months of doing that, maybe even slightly less, because we've been working so hard in the run up to the opening. We hadn't then given ourselves any space. It was actually, you know, the way these projects always work is you end up working, you know, till right till the very end and then open the doors when still stuff's not done. But obviously the dream really would have been getting everything absolutely ready and then probably pushing the opening a week, letting ourselves actually relax, get into a better headspace. But ultimately the money tap needed to be turned on. You know, we needed some money.
We were broke and we had rent that was coming up. And the sort of 1% of brain power I had left was spent watching Bully in the evening with you, trying to wonder who was the president of Rhodesia
for $9 or whatever.
And the funny thing is, I know I consumed about, you know, 300 hours of Bully, and I can't tell you the format. I can't remember. I don't know how it worked. I remember there was darts involved, based. And there was sort of 1970s pop trivia questions. And that's all I remember.
The only thing I will say, though, is that was also one of the best times ever.
Yeah, it was also exciting in its own way.
This is the thing about projects. That's actually the advice I'd give to someone who's doing it, is you've really got to try and enjoy those times, because, yeah, we were exhausted. We had no money. But this is also kind of the exciting times. That's the thing, the pioneer days, where everything's new. Because everything's new, everything's a bit stressful. So it's really hard to actually enjoy it, in inverted commas, because, you know, you're obviously freaked out about paying all your bills, paying all your staff, let alone getting customers through the door. It's quite hard to. But, you know, actually, the two of us getting to spend that much time together and actually be involved with the project from the get-go, we hadn't got a clue what we were doing. We were learning on the go. You've got to try and enjoy it.
Yeah, and I think people will agree with this, but the highs are very high, because suddenly it feels like you've not wasted all your money and your life and everything. And the lows are very low, because it's just because the stakes are so high.
Yeah.
If you do something like that, the stakes are so high that the desperation for it to succeed means that when you get little good bits of good day or good news, it means everything to you. So we were at the time living and dying sort of on the number of people we were getting in per hour, weren't we?
Yeah.
I mean, you know, and maybe
all the time.
Yeah. You'd get like a few extra people come in at like 5 o'clock and I'd be buzzing. And then not very many people come in over the 6 o'clock and I'd be depressed again. Like, it was so, yeah, it was such an emotional time.
Yeah. And it's, you know, and that's a nice thing is as the business grows, now we try and judge it on months, quarters, even years. You know, now we're six years in, whereas back then, and I'm still guilty of it a bit, you know, like whenever we see it, you know, we obviously still have days where not many people turn up, you know, and it's still hard not to be a bit like, you know, fall back into that mindset. But, you know, I'm happy to say that at least we've now got sort of at least enough evidence to suggest that an off day is an off day, not a sort of a pattern that's about to emerge.
Yeah. Yeah. I think I've got past that. Now, I think I'm sort of interested. I'm definitely interested, and I want to know that things are going well. But I think I've managed to zoom out to more like year on year stuff now, rather than day on day.
Yeah, well, which is big bit of advice. You've got to get there.
Yeah, you've got to get there.
You can't let your emotions shift like that.
So let's get a bit more. Let's zoom out a little bit now for a moment.
Okay.
If someone is listening to this, and I imagine the only people still are listening to this are people who are interested in maybe trying to set up their own climbing wall one day.
Yeah.
Do you think it is a good investment?
Ooh. Yes, is a short answer, but I'm going to caveat that very aggressively. Was it a good investment for us? Yes, it was. You know, at the time in 2016, our startup costs were significantly lower than they are today. You know, every line on our P&L, you know, profit and loss, you know, all our investment will be lower. And that, you know, so we've really benefited from that. That is to say, though, climbing is still growing. And for me, it's, I reckon we could have thrown got our bully dartboard out with a map of the UK, lobbed a dart at it, and as long as it hit a major city, we probably would have been successful. Maybe yes,
it was the timing was very fortunate. Yeah.
Yeah. So we weren't really at risk of failure in terms of where. Whereas today, if I was looking at it, there are still areas of the country that I would look at and think, no, there is money to be made there. But you do have to be careful. You know, we were very fortunate with our situation. You know, we obviously had to give him, you know, big shout out to our dad for the support, all the support he gave us, you know, with opening the ballroom, and that, you know, that allowed us some flexibility. Whereas today, if we were, for example, were having to take big startup loans, the interest rates are now a lot higher than they were back then. And the cost of just doing business is higher. So there are more risks, you know? So, it really, for me personally, would be on like a sort of location by location basis. If someone just says, is a climbing wall a good investment? The answer is maybe. But if you can find a good building in a good location, yeah, I think the sport is growing. The sport is getting very popular. But I would definitely say to someone, oh, if you think your local small town can handle a bouldering wall, maybe just, you know, take a beat.
Yeah, I think I'm a little bit more negative, perhaps, because I think there are so many benefits to running an operating climbing wall. If you're an obsessive climber, you get to spend your life talking about and being surrounded by climbers and climbing. And that is something that's really valuable in itself. But I think if you're looking at it as a pure financial investment, until the prices come down for things like plywood and getting anyone to come and do any work, you know, wall builders and everything. This, again, is kind of England-based. I don't know what the situation is abroad. But it's so, the startup cost is now so expensive. And we're talking double what we paid in 2016, 2017, if not more now. And it's kind of a hangover from COVID and Brexit and everything. But if you're looking at a purely financial point of view, I think your payback period of your initial investment will be so bad that your lease might actually expire before that happens. Before you profited back that money, you may even have run out of lease. And I think by the time that starts to be the formula, then you've got to be really worried that your landlord doesn't want to extend your lease. So I think you could get into a situation where you haven't actually, even though you've been relatively successful as a climbing wall, you haven't got your money back before your lease has expired.
That's always scary. I think what I will, again, I'll add another caveat in on a more positive note, is one thing that, Sam, you always said to me in the early days, when the ballroom was, teetering's the wrong word, but when it wasn't booming, you always said to me that, you know, I could leave and quit and go and get a job, but you would always just live and die in the ballroom. You know, you would just live, climb, and just, you know, let people in, you know, as long as you possibly could. I think that's also a really valid point, because if someone's out there thinking, I hate my job, I would happily earn a small amount of money, as long as, you know, my bills are paid and I get to live in and around climbers and in climbing walls. You know, if your lifestyle choice is that's fine and you don't need a huge amount of money, then actually, you know, it could be fine. You know,
yeah. If you're a lifer like me, as you say, as long as I could carry on affording food, I would have kept the doors open. I would have slept there if I needed to. I would have just lived it. As long as I keep affording food. But a lot of people, you know, want to see some kind of return on their investment.
Well, I'll tell you the other big problem you've got. So if the two of us took a magnifying glass to the quality of the ballroom in 2016, the day we opened, versus, let's say, one of the newer hangars, the newer depots, the big centres, it's chalk and cheese. And that's the problem people have got. When we opened the ballroom, climbing walls weren't really a big thing. You know, there weren't mega centres in every city in the country. So actually, the fact that there was a dedicated bouldering wall was incredible to people. They turned up and said, wow, this is amazing. Whereas now there is so much comparison, not just, you know, across the UK, but social media across, you know, across the globe, of these giga centres that have, you know, 10 million square foot, a million holds, all the most expensive holds, you know, that cost millions of pounds to build. And then they go down to their local and go, this isn't the same. This isn't Innsbruck. This is ridiculous.
Yeah.
But I think that's scary.
Well, speaking of Innsbruck, I remember really twisting your arm to get as much money as I possibly could into the holds budget at the time, because I knew the holds budget was going to be important. And we bought all of our holds to set up for £20,000.
I believe the final figure was £25,000. I remember adjusting my little spreadsheet that I
had. Yes. No, I do remember that. Yes, it was. It was up to 25.
You squeeze out 25 grand, which, and that was filled, you know, you managed to get that to fill the entire centre. Is an interesting description.
It was a bit sparse, but
we had an entire climbing walls worth of holds for £25,000 today.
No chance. You would struggle to get, you know, you'd get three good circuits for that maybe, but it's totally changed. Also, what people expect has changed. You know, people,
and that's kind of continuing from my point, really. Is, you know, when we opened, the fact we had holds, you know, we had a few kind of bigger macros that were kind of cool. And people were amazed by that. Whereas now when you can go online and watch people climb on, you know, these German climbing walls that have very few routes or blocks up, but they're incredible. And they're all using the most expensive holds and they're all really comfy. People see that and then come to, you know, our climbing wall and be like, oh, you haven't got any of those, therefore it's not great. It's, you know, it would be a tough comparison. And, you know, we'll both admit we've had to spend probably four times that in holds on the ballroom since, you know, to bring it into line to what we believe is, you know, isn't an amazing center.
Exactly. Because we've constantly had to reinvest. But I would say, if you're really excited to get into climbing wall ownership, do it for the love of climbing, not for money, because the climbing walls are never going to make as much money as people think they do. No. But they are fun. Like, I have apps, like, you know, would I do it again, even if, you know, if I had to get into it now and make, a more sketchy investment, I still would, because it's been so much fun to be a part of.
Yeah. You know, and we have had some amazing experiences and a lot of doors opening. You know, it said, like, just being in the industry, you know, we've now met so many other owners of climbing walls, you know, we've got involved, and we would never have been able to do that. You know, if we were always on the other side of the coin as, you know, climbing wall goers as opposed to owners, you know, there is a different side to things. And it is amazing to meet other people in the industry. And we've got to watch the industry grow, because it was, so unprofessional 6 years ago.
Yes, wow. Wow, how much it's changed in that time. Just the amount of people climbing has changed. Yeah. Climbing is now common. You know, it's common enough that almost everybody knows what it is.
Yeah.
Which doesn't sound like a lot, but wow, that's a massive change from... It's
a big shift.
Yeah, and particularly when I first started climbing, it was still weird. You know, bouldering was still the sort of... It was accepted as its own sport, but it was like kind of the bastard of the real sports. You know, I'm a bit being at uni and in our climbing club, I was the only person who was just bouldering for life, you know, just so not interested in ropes and trad yeah. and stuff. I just wanted to go bouldering. I was the only one with that kind of level of drive, at least. Yeah. I mean, obviously there are some people that were basically just in uni clubs for a drinking club, weren't they? But
uni clubs are always difficult for that. But it is true, you know, whereas now most of the university clubs we see, they're just bouldering clubs. You know, they do some ropes, you know, but also rope facilities are pretty Spartan and pretty, you know, there aren't that many of them around the country. You know, I think in Coventry, obviously we're lucky. Well, we're not rope climbers, but you know, the Warwick facility does have great ropes.
And there's a reason why there aren't very many, you know, rope centers opening up in the UK. And again, it's a location problem. There aren't all that many spaces that are appropriate. They're very expensive and you can only have two people on each line at a time. So the density you can get is much lower. So they just don't have the same financial upside as the bouldering, which is why the UK is not building very many big rope centers. And so probably we'll see I imagine our roped athletes will lag behind the likes that are training in Innsbruck all the time and in world-class centres. But our boulderers are doing very well. So, and also we do have good rope climbers as well, but in many ways, it's almost impressive. It's more impressive they managed to get to where they are given the state of rope climbing in comparison to bouldering.
Well, if you give someone like Max Milne a shout out, you know, for look, his bouldering is, you know, well, came sixth in the World Cup circuit. Was it last year? And where did we know his humble beginnings up in Scotland? You know, he wasn't climbing in something incredible. That was just, you know, I can't even remember the name of whatever the small facility he was climbing in. But
right, somewhere in Inverness, wasn't it? But it's he's a freak of nature. How he got so good at comp style bouldering on that facility is just unreal. How good. Oh, it's just unbelievable. Yeah. I never really understand how he managed to do it.
His natural talent level must be... Yeah, his midichlorians for climbing are off the charts.
His midichlorians are off the charts. must be. But anyway, right.
Yeah.
We've covered so much ground and also, in a way, no ground, which is so typical for this podcast. Like, it just takes a very long time to say stuff. So we might get a bunch more questions come in from people who listen to this and want us to go into more detail. And if you have more questions, then you can send them over. Obviously, if you're a patroon, then you've got a much higher chance of having their questions actually answered. But we'll try our best anyway. So if we do get loads of questions, we might have to revisit this. But in the meantime, we do have some patroon questions, which we will prioritize, obviously. We love our patroons.
Absolutely.
So let's go through some of these. So Majos asks, what do you think about board-only commercial gyms? Magnus opened one with some new kind of app and light-up hold setup. I'm not sure how that went.
So, I mean, I think you are more qualified to talk about this than I am, but I'll give my two cents from what I've seen. We have seen a couple of these attempted in the UK, and I don't think the market for high-end climbing outside of maybe somewhere in London is big enough for these gyms to really take off on a commercial level. I think on a lower level, if someone is willing to, kind of, again, as a lifestyle business to run it, they can function. But I just don't think we have enough people who are interested day in, day out to be board climbing, only board climbing at a center and pay an amount of money that would make it commercially worthwhile in the UK. But as I said, that's what I think.
Yeah, I think you, same as you really, it's a density problem because boards are very, very hard. So you rule out all of your beginners and even intermediates really. But what could work is the pure gym model. Ben and I have spoken about this as well, of just having a place where everyone has a key and can just go in and have a climb, like the school room in Sheffield. I think there could definitely be one of those in London. Yep. The benefit being you don't need very much space. And if you manage to figure out the pure gym model of having no staff, then I think it could do really, really well and be a really cool facility. Like, it's the sort of place, like, if I was in London, I'd be really excited to go to if it was, you know, if it was available. But
it's again, you need someone that'd be willing to put a lot of money up front. Because if you did it on the cheap, and I think it would look at, you'd all people would know it, was if you actually, you know, you went in and you put kilter boards, moon boards, you know, really spent a lot of really good money, an amazing splatter board, you know, and really built a fantastic little center. I think it could do well. Particularly, but I said I would stick to London. You know, you put that, it may be Sheffield again. Obviously, it's, you know, Sheffield's got the schoolroom. So,
and I also just don't know how in the UK you could get that concept properly past an insurer.
No, I mean, I have spoken to insurers about this, and it's a bit of a classic. Someone's got to jump first. So what insurance companies tend to say is, not a problem. You can do what you want. You have to risk assess it. And then it only then gets tested when someone seriously injures themselves at 3 a.m. You know, you didn't have CCTV. You had no idea. You go in and, you know, they're still there on the matting struggling, you know, and then they sue you. And that's when you find out whether your insurers will back you, you know, and that's the problem.
My fear is that, and I don't know how Pure Gym does it, but I imagine they've got some CCTV monitoring. Yeah. And my feeling is that the only way to fully get it past insurers would be to say that there's someone monitoring CCTV.
I think you'd have to.
And without that, I don't see how, because also, do you really want to own a facility where someone gets seriously injured and then is stuck there?
Or has a heart attack and dies.
And then someone comes in at like 8 a.m. but like, oh, there's a dead guy in here.
Dead guy, yeah, sorry.
Oh. Yeah, that's, I'm not sure I would necessarily want to be involved with that, just because, as I say, the stress of running a climbing wall is bad enough. Yeah. I mean, we've honestly not even scratched the surface of stuff that went dramatically wrong at the Borums and social as well. Stuff goes wrong all the time. And Yeah, I think that would just, I would just feel even more worried about it if there wasn't even any staff there to look after it. So I think in the UK, if I was being involved, I would want there to be at least one staff member there. And for that to be the case, that might kill the bottom line. Yeah.
Well, as I said, if anyone wants to try it, I'd love to hear a business plan if people are keen. But
I'd love to watch it. I'd love to watch someone else give it a go.
Yeah.
Because as I say, the closest thing we've got to that is the schoolroom in Sheffield, and it's amazing.
Which you love. So
I love it. Yeah. Literally just written an article about how much I love it. So
coming soon.
Yeah, coming soon. Next series of next Spotter magazine, you'll see that article. Anyway, so I think we're not unsure on that one.
Unsure. Yeah.
Unsure. What else? Okay, so Bryce. And I happen to know Bryce also runs a climbing wall. So he probably has a few of these of his own. But he says, can you share a birthday party horror story or two?
Well, I can. And I can share one. And it was actually, I think, the most miserable thing I've ever witnessed in life, let alone
a climbing wall.
It was one of our earliest birthday parties. Where a parent had clearly organized a birthday party for about 15, 20 kids. It was a lot of kids. And the birthday boy clearly was not liked by anyone. And so they all came and they all sort of like were high-fiving each other, but none of them were really engaging with the birthday party, the birthday boy. And then the birthday boy went and hit one of them while he was climbing.
Justifiable, I'd say.
Yeah, and that was it. And it really, and it just, as I said, I've never been a bit more sad. I think becoming a dad makes me even more sad.
This
could be your kid. Like, the parents have done everything right. They've organized, you know, a ballroom birthday, potentially the best birthday party anyone could ever dream of.
Or so saith our website.
Yeah, don't look at reviews. but you know, all the kids had an amazing time, but the birthday kid, And for me, that was, you know, that was a horror story. Obviously, maybe that might not be what you're expecting, but for me, that was one of the saddest things I had to witness.
Yeah, I suppose it, as a dad now, that is like your nightmare, isn't it? Is to host a birthday party and then see that either nobody turns up, which is like the ultimate nightmare, or they do turn up, but they clearly. And I remember that party. I don't think I was there, but I remember you telling me that they were all interacting with each other, but not with him.
Not with him, and then he started hitting them.
It might be because the hitting was pre-existing problem.
Yes.
It might be because they didn't talk to him because he throws fives all the time.
Yeah, it could well have been.
He's throwing hands again. But that was a tragic one. I remember one where we had no recollection of booking it. And we didn't think it had been booked. We had no message, and they just all turned up, and we had basically no one to do it. And I remember us sort of just like panic running it, and it was just, it actually went sort of okay, but it was just so embarrassing.
Yes. And turning up an event. Yeah.
And we also had the woman who had a full birthday party and then didn't pay us.
That was actually the one I was about to mention as well. Yeah. Mm. That one I think actually does stand out because, you know, Sam, this is again a valuable lesson. Any business owner, let alone wall owner, when someone's paid for something and not pay the deposit, make sure they pay before they do the thing.
Yes. Yeah.
Because it turned out she didn't have a complaint. It wasn't like she came and said, that was the worst birthday party ever, I'm not paying. She just snuck out.
And turned her phone off, didn't she?
Yeah, you called her once and she answered. And then as soon as you said who it was, she hung up. And then that was it. Never heard from her again.
Yeah.
You know, again, we were, you know, that was early door stuff. And so, you know, that would have been a few £100 that we were banking on.
Yes. Yeah. We needed that money back then. Really needed everything. And that really sucked. But because our birthday party stories aren't that good, let's flesh them out a bit with a couple of bad customer stories. What about your customer? Do you remember the one with the birthday present?
Yes. So I believe you're referencing when I was at the desk when a mother came up with two girls and she was very pleasant. We were going through the booking process. She signed the waiver for both of them. Bear in mind, these girls were probably six. So like very much at the lowest end of, you know, the age bracket we allow. And she paid up and she went, cool, see you girls, I'm off. And, you know, prepared to leave the building. At which point I sort of said, really sorry, but, you know, they are six. It's actually technically an extreme sport. So do need you to, you know, stay and supervise your children. She melted down. Absolutely melted down, and just said, oh, she turned to the girls and said, I'm really sorry, I can't go and buy you birthday presents because this man says I've got to actually be here with you.
So yes,
just like, really sorry, but that is just kind of in our terms and conditions, you need to be there. But the kicker came when an unknown lady came out of nowhere and just said, oh, okay, look, you know, that's awful. I'm so sorry. You obviously need to go and buy birthday presents. Let me look after your children for you, which is fine by me. It doesn't matter. We doesn't matter to us who looks after them as long as she's okay with it.
Yeah, as long as she signed the waiver.
Turned around, was like, oh, she just needs to go and do some shopping and didn't actually need to buy the birthday presents at all.
Yeah. So she lied to their kids to try and make you feel bad. That's happened a bunch where someone's come in, not read the obvious thing on the website that says you need to have someone to look at your kids while they, you know, partake in this dangerous activity they've never done before. Yeah. And then they go like, oh, we can't do it, I'm afraid, because this man tells this us man, we can't.
Point the little finger at you.
I think one of the worst ones I ever had was that woman who paid for her. We also had that woman who paid for herself. Do you remember that? That was staggering. We had a woman come in with her two kids. She paid for herself to climb and she made her kids watch so she could see if it was good or not.
and then didn't actually, you know, pay anything at all.
Yeah, kids didn't get to do it. Yeah. That was a good one.
The other ones we've had that I remember are people not understanding the bouldering concept. So, you know, it was quite busy at the desk and this woman came up and I was chatting to her and she was like, cool, so where are the harnesses?
Yes.
Bouldering, no harnesses. That is a death trap. There is no way in hell I'll be letting me or my child climb here. How dare you?
Yeah.
Walk down the stairs. And you're left just thinking like, oh, and everyone else is standing around like slightly awkwardly. Like, well, you stay. What? Like,
yeah. Yeah, yeah, another classic. Do you remember in the early days when people had this really, and this again shows like people's knowledge of climbing, some people would come up and assumed it was free.
Yes.
They would assume that they could climb in this facility for free, and they were shocked that we were asking for money to take part.
I think they assumed it was some council-funded project. Like, I don't know what that was.
I don't know what, because there's nothing, unfortunately, with the state of councils in the UK, there is nothing you can do for free. No. So I don't really know where they got that from. But anyway, they assumed it was free. And I remember this one woman had come up with her son and assumed it was free. And I had to say, no, I'm afraid, you know, you have to pay. And at the time, you know, she had to pay a entry for him and registration and rental shoes and stuff. And she was sort of like a bit annoyed about it, but was sort of okay with me. And then she gave him the rental shoes and turned to him and was like, well, you best enjoy this because this guy's just robbed me of £10. She also used some expletives, which I've removed.
Yeah, very good.
Well, that was a bad one. But
I think I can share. You want to talk about bad customers? I actually will share a social climbing experience then. As I said, this one was, I think, the worst example of an adult versus a child, where people don't understand that supervise your child does not mean have a coffee in the cafe and just hope that they're okay. It obviously means you have to be on the matting with them, et cetera, et cetera. So there's one lady, obviously, you know, was having a coffee in the cafe. Staff go up to her and say, look, really sorry, can you please watch your child? She's a bit sarkily says, sure. And then they go back. And then obviously she carries on drinking her coffee and gets to the point where this, you know, she is then running over, running around on the matting, jumping up and down saying, is this supervising? Is this supervising? And at which point, you know, I think the staff have to say, potentially it's time.
I think it's time we supervise you to the door, love.
And she screamed the place down. It's ridiculous. She runs out. Her child was only sort of, I don't know, she was sub 10, young girl. She left her child in the building unsupervised, you know, while she was smoking outside. And then this poor child comes over to the desk and apologizes on behalf of the mother. And I think
that is tragic, isn't it?
The worst example of just like adult versus child interaction.
That kid trying to do the nice thing there probably got a thick ear for that.
Yeah, exactly.
I can't imagine that mum was then really nice to me. Oh, did you go back and apologize to me and my mom?
Oh, good.
Oh, that's so good of you. Yeah, I bet.
I couldn't.
I bet he got his lights punched out for that. Oh gosh, we've got so many other stories that we're just not going to get time for, but perhaps if, you know, we might do a few more sometime. But anyway, let's move on. Moritz, Moritz has asked, do you have any thoughts on a career in climbing gyms apart from being the owner? Lots of gyms nowadays have primarily part-time employees, and the gyms don't necessarily offer lots of options for growth.
It's a really good point. I know Moritz is involved with Climbing Wars as well, so he's probably seen this firsthand.
So Ben is also one of the hidden patroons.
Yeah,
I know which username he is, but it's a mystery. But he is a patroon member, so he's aware of the patroons.
You are welcome to guess. I was also just don't want to brag, but patroon number one.
You're giving it away. Everyone scrolls back.
Oh well, there you go. If anyone wants to scroll all the way back to the beginning, you can probably work it out. But no, so like it is very difficult, and it is something that, you know, we have struggled with at, you know, at Boreham and at Social, because we are a small operator. But what I will say with small businesses in terms of career growth, maybe it's not like your big corporate chains where you start from the bottom, as it were, and, you know, work your way up the corporate ladder to a sort of CEO post. That's not the same thing. But what you do get the opportunity to do in these small businesses normally is be involved with almost every part of the business. You know, so on, you know, at the Ballroom, you can be in part of sales, you can be in part of marketing, you can get involved with route setting, you can get involved with, you know, the safety side, the maintenance of the building, you know, so you can really build a skill set that is extremely valuable in other businesses. So it is difficult to say, you know, is there a career path? The obvious career path these days, because the industry is growing, is as a coach and as a route setter. Because
as a manager, I suppose.
Or as a manager, but the thing about the manager is that's kind of the peak. As you know, so that's where you're kind of aiming, but there isn't really anywhere to go beyond manager. You know, so whereas I would say, so in terms of uncapped potential, is obviously if you wanted to be a freelance route setter and a freelance coach, you know, you can make good money, you know, going around different centers, particularly as a route setter. The moment, you know, if you had good experience setting for years at a center, then that's experience would then, you know, be able to expand out. But I think sadly, climbing walls as individual businesses aren't big enough. Like we're not big enough to have a head of marketing. You know, we're not big enough to have a, you know, head of sales. You know, we are a small business.
So slightly unrelated, but I think if people have a lot of money and want to get involved with climbing as a business, I don't think climbing walls are the best option right now. I would say the bigger gaps in the market is trying to service the many, many more climbers we've got in other ways. Yeah. So I think basically a holds companies, I think there is so much capacity for British hold companies. Yeah. It's so expensive getting them all away from Bulgaria every time. Yeah. And Core do very well. And they are a UK hold company. So you know that it works as a concept. I'm sure that is a very strong, I think that would be a much better investment. And also I think a good, popular, cool clothing brand.
You use the word cool there. That's tough.
Well, this is the problem because I actually heard a conversation on another podcast where they were asking, basically the guy was saying, name a climber that dresses well in climbing clothing. And all they could do was name Keenan, an American climber. And what they said was, he dresses like a skater. And so immediately that all falls down. He's like, okay, so he's not, that's the problem is he hasn't dressed like a climber. He's not wearing climbing clothing and looking cool. He's like, he's looked at climbing clothing and gone, well, that sucks. I'm going to wear stuff from another sport that is cool. So I would say that is a better, I mean, obviously I'm completely off topic with this, but I think those are my two things that I would love to, well, maybe not, you know, see, it's probably not really, I'm not going to get too involved with it now, but I would love to see more companies opening up in that area.
Well, I think the point you're making, which is very valid, is like, we've seen this mountain explode, you know, of climbing walls and climbing, but the ancillary businesses around climbing have yet to fortify, you know, and build. So if you want to have a kind of career, you know, there will be like a clothing brand, you know, may well, like Nike, for example, may well expand to have a climbing extension, you know, so there'll be a huge career path there.
Yeah, you said
endorse Nike.
Said that very succinctly. I'm the podcaster. Get your own podcast.
starting from
exactly. He also asked thoughts on screw-on only climbing walls from a gym owner's perspective.
Well, it's quite funny, we're obviously literally as we speak are having our annual maintenance check from our maintenance man who sort of checks the walls, and I think he would be horror, you know, aghast at the concept of a screw-on only facility. Tells us every year we're using too many, and we're damaging the wood. And I personally agree, not in terms of what we do, but I think a purely screw-on is a bit more life limiting to the, you know, your investment. I obviously I'm not a route setter, so I can't speak to it from a route setting. I'll also lead that down to you. But from an investment perspective, no, I like bolts because they're not infinitely reusable, but kind of.
Yeah, pretty much. And I actually agree with you at the moment. I don't think it's ready yet because there's not enough diversity in screw-on jugs particularly. So like all of your easy stuff, your ladders, You don't want to have, like, because they've got, you know, they're a big hold, they're quite far out from the wall, so the angle of the pressure is quite far away, so the fulcrum is quite dangerous.
Yeah.
So for it to be safe, you'd need to have at least three, and I reckon some of them potentially four screws to make sure it's solid. And no one's making those, really. And if they are, there's not much of a variety. So you'd have to have all of your easy stuff with the same hold type. And yeah, right now, you want to be as diverse as possible. But I think hold companies could lead that, you know, could push that charge more. And if there were more options, and you were never limited, because if you've got bolts on your wall, you can have your cake and eat it too. You can have your screw-ons and your bolt-ons. Yeah. So right now, it would be a bit of a loss to lose all your bolts. And I know you can kind of screw through a lot of them and drill through, make new holes. And climbing hold companies mostly sort of try and say that's probably okay if it's done safely. But obviously, if one did break, I think they would immediately say, well, you bolted it. I think step back. But
yeah, that would scare me from an insurance perspective. If a hold shattered that we had drilled a screw on into, I don't think that hold company's not going to go, yeah, we said it was fine. I think you'd find it. Go, whoa, did what?
So I think maybe the future, but only if hold companies kind of push it that way, I think.
Cool.
He also asked why British gyms are so cold.
Well, so I'm actually with you here, Moritz. You know, I am not as hardcore as our host here. And I remember going to some of the London walls back in the day, and I couldn't even warm up. And I don't really know why, but I'd say now it's more of a cost of living crisis.
It's cost. You know, it's just cost. It's expense.
Back then, you know, but it is true. You know, like, you know, because quite often you've got these enormous industrial units that have a gas blower that even if you turned it on all day, probably wouldn't really change much. So, you know, as we found when we set up the ballroom, landlords aren't putting in central heating. They might suggest to you, sure, get a gas blower, but you're not. It's not going. It won't change the overall temperature. And now the cost of running them is astronomical.
Yeah, I would also say in the UK, it's too hot in climbing walls. Just absolutely too hot to have a good time about 6 weeks out of the year, yeah. And it's absolutely too cold about 6 weeks out of the year. But the expense of fixing it completely, it's just not worth it for those 6 weeks. You basically just have 6 weeks where it's too cold and 6 weeks where it's too hot, because the rest of the year it's fine.
Yeah. And obviously the too cold problem is actually significantly easier to deal with than too hot. You know, too cold is most people will still come and they'll, you know, you go to a gym, you'll warm up, but too hot.
Yeah. Fine. Yeah. He's also pointed out that British gyms have a primary focus on climbing and not so much on creating a nice place to hang out. Little options for food and drinks and things. And we've noticed that as well, that in gyms on the continent have much more, you know, like a lot of French gyms have like a proper restaurant and stuff.
I had a steak dinner. When I went climbing in Lille, you know, and it is interesting. And again, we have dabbled in food at the at other climbing gyms. And it just hasn't really taken off. And, you know, we're not going to probably name them, but we do know of some climbing gyms in the UK that have spent significant money on their food offerings. And it's not profitable. Now, maybe it's sort of a lost leader that brings people in. They have an amazing time. Maybe that's true. But the food is kind of is an aside. The user experience point is something that Sam and I have actually learned a lot about opening Leicester. When we opened the ballroom, user experience was about 45th on our list of things to think about. You know, it wasn't at the top ever. It was just climbing, climbing, climbing. And then when we came across the guys we opened Leicester with, their focus was the complete opposite. It was all user experience, and climbing was kind of irrelevant. They might disagree with that, but that's kind of how it felt. And at the time, I was quite judgmental of that. And I definitely have over the years learned that user experience is actually probably more valuable, not more valuable than the climbing, but I'm saying more valuable than we judged it. Because I think genuinely, it's very valuable. And having a nicer environment, a nicer place for people to come in, to relax outside of the climbing, and just to be, is very valuable. And it's something that lots of climbing walls have completely ignored in this country.
Yeah, no, I agree. It is definitely something that I think will move. I think it will get better, but Our final question we're going to cover today then is from Remus. And he asks, I'd be interested to hear your thoughts on in-house setters versus getting external people, or even getting a third party company to manage all the setting plus hold purchasing.
Well, you're poking the hornet's nest here, and a big, big question regarding insurance, essentially.
Large question.
I'm not going to get into the insurance. I think the insurance is a boring issue. The frank matter, the issue the UK currently faces is UK setters do not have insurance largely. And there's a lot of questions around what that means for the industry. But in terms of just purely external versus internal, we have always taken the view at both the walls to do a bit of both. You know, Sam is obviously himself, he won't admit it because he never admits anything, but he's a very strong setter himself. You know, so we've always had him, you know, leading the way in Coventry. And we've got Orin Coley at Social, who is again extremely strong. And they sort of underpin our setting strategy. And then we get externals on top. And then we also have an in-house team that we sort of grow alongside it. So we kind of have a sort of hybrid of all of those, which I think works really well. Because you need someone like Sam and Orin at the centers to quality control. I think when you just have externals coming in with no support from internals, that can lead to maybe some erratic results, not in terms of the quality of the setting, but in terms of the grades and the overall
grading atmosphere. Definitely. Yeah.
Grading is a big one. The question of obviously, would we get an external company in? No.
We don't need one. Exactly. I could totally see in some places where they would need one. I think if you don't know climbing that well, don't do your own hold ordering. That's a big mistake. If you're not confident, call up the likes of Impact, or let's give a shout out to our previous guest, Jake Mason. He'll sort your hold ordering for you.
Very confident.
Yeah, don't do that if you're not confident. But if you are confident, it is doable. And it will save you money to do it yourself. My thoughts on setting, I could honestly talk for a whole podcast on, because it's in a situation which is just terrible. Yeah. And it's kind of gotten to this point where there are such a small pool of setters that are kind of nationally trusted.
Yeah.
And you want to fill up your roster with them. And there's a huge pool of people who are trying to get into it.
Yeah.
And that pool's only going to get bigger as climbing's got so much bigger. But they, at the moment, the current state of affairs is, you know, back in the day, you used to get into setting by doing loads of free work and then working for very, very cheap or as like an apprentice. And then when you were good enough, you started charging full dollar. At the moment, the current situation seems to be mostly have a go at setting, charge full dollar.
Yep.
You basically get messages and emails from people who are saying, you know, I've set at one or two other places. I'd like to come set at you all, but they're charging you almost as much, maybe 10 or 20 quid less, but almost as much as the proper, some of the, you know, the best guys
that we have in this country. That
you can get in the country. So you have to ask, what is the business case for the person you're asking for their whole product to be a complete throw of the dice? It's like, imagine sending a message to a restaurant and saying, I've cooked a couple of times before. Some people say I'm good at cooking. I would like to come and cook all your food.
Yeah, that is an analogy you've used many times. And it opens people's eyes to the importance of setting, because I think lots of people don't see it as actually everything we do. We've had to say this so many times to people over the years. Don't forget that we're not selling anything but the way we arrange these holds on the wall.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. That's it. That's the whole product.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, obviously there's the whole user experience around it is great, but that's our product. I'm not going to name the climbing wall this story is about, but it was, you know, one that when we opened, we were talking with them, and they were celebrating how they were setting while inebriated. And also they had just put a poll out on their social media and got a whole bunch of like just mates and random people off the street to come set their opening set. And they were saying how amazing that was. And I was just like, okay.
Yeah. Yeah. And yeah, over the years, setting is taken more seriously as a profession, yeah, as it needs to be. But, and we've said it so many times, there needs to be a better pathway to get setters in. And all of the top setters have got there through one of two ways. One is they're a former like comp or current comp competitor, and so are very well known as a name, and they're super strong and they understand movement. And so it's kind of a good guess that they'll be good setters, and they basically all are. Yeah. If you're good enough to be a World Cup climber, you'll be able to set as well, because you understand movement. So there's that, or they've done the hard yards themselves. Like when I first started setting for the Arch, I'd say at least 6 or 7 times totally for free. And then for a while I was setting for very little.
Yeah.
And basically, you know, cover my costs. Because I was aware that the product I was offering wasn't very good.
Yeah.
And also, if you're able to just get some experience setting, you can go in, focus on setting one or two boulders. Whereas if you've told someone that you can replace their, you know, superstar setter for a week, you can't just go and set in a couple of problems. You're petrified about setting enough problems.
Well, we are, though. This is actually a very dangerous point in the industry, because obviously everyone hates when you hear about come to our apprenticeship. It's unpaid. It is very difficult with people that aren't living at home to go, okay, well, maybe you're going to have to do 6 months of work for free to maybe then get a job. So like, I do sympathize with people that are trying to break into the industry, because at the moment, there is no career path for root setters. Sam has laid out the career path. That is what you do currently. You know, I know there are, you know, the castle had an apprenticeship scheme to root setting, and you know, but it's not widespread yet.
Some places have them, but more don't than do.
There's no like nationally recognized apprenticeship scheme, you know, yet.
And
that's what needs to happen, because there needs to be a way of getting into the industry other than, you know, get the top, you know, become a world-class climber, and then you can become a setter. Like that's, you know, that is how it happens, but that's a long road, and that's tough to do.
I also have another way that I don't see people trying, but I think would be a really good way of getting into it. Find a well-respected setter and ask them if you could come with them as like an assistant, because I bet if one of our setters said to us, oh, I'm bringing an apprentice, you don't have to pay them, but I'm just sort of teaching them the ropes. If they did that for a few times, and then that same setter said, they're good enough, you can get them in.
Yeah.
I would fully trust them and I'd get them in. Yeah. So that's another way, I think, but you don't see people doing that so much,
that's because it would require kind of a ballsy move. You know, like you're messaging your Alex Fries, you know, like saying, can I be your apprentice? It's quite scary. You know,
so, definitely. Yeah.
You had to put yourself out there to, you know, to get anywhere. I think that's very fair.
Something in life as well.
Life advice to end us there.
So to sum up that question, I would say right now you have to get in externals and you have to do whatever you can to make sure your product is as good as possible. Yeah. Because it's all you sell. But I also do understand, you know, some walls trying to keep the price low, and you know, if you've got really, really good internals, great. But I also think you want a bit of variety.
You know, we're lucky to have some very good internals at both our centres. But that's, you know, the same people set week in, week out. It will get stale.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's that. I think that's all the questions we've got time for today. I don't think we've got any others I can immediately see. Thanks very much for doing that, bro.
Oh, thank you very much.
I know we've got so many more stories that didn't come up. So we could potentially come back and do another one in the future, or something a bit more directed. And if we get lots of questions, maybe we can we can do some more. But
I think the people.
if they like it, then we might be able to produce some more of it. But in general, it's a rarity that you're listening to the Careless Talk Climb podcast and we don't have Aiden as well. That's not going to become the usual. If you listen to that, thank you very much, and we'll be back to our normal service next week. But thank you very much to my brother Ben for joining us.
No, really, really enjoyed it. Thanks a lot for having me.